I am John, Whoopi impersonator and a Ladrin warlock with the Warriors of the Stars. Along came Jason, my bearded friend. Fabulous secret ideas were revealed to me the day he came to my house and said, I want to make a podcast! Only two others share this secret. Eric of the Loch Ness and Jacob. Together we started talking about toys, comics, games, and movies on the Super Awesome Geek Show!
Welcome to another exciting episode of the Super Awesome Geek Show. We've got a pretty cool Star Wars episode again for you today, continuing on what we had last week with Jacob and the Forlom thing. This time we've got Gus Lopez.
Oh, hey guys. Sorry. I thought we were going to introduce the other hosts first.
I was waiting for that.
Yeah. Way to go, John.
Hey, you know, we're on the fly. I'm shaking up, you know. Yeah, so
try it again, or do you want to, are you going to edit it?
Oh.
We'll fix it in post.
We can just put it in the way it is.
All right. I can do an intro.
But I'm here with Jason Rigdon.
Hello.
And Rob Clifford.
Hey, guys.
And we have special guest, Gus Lopez.
Thrilled to be on.
Gus runs the SWCA website, the Star Wars Collectors Archive website, right?
That's right, yeah. It's one of the, when I got into Star Wars collecting, one of the first things I did was set up that website.
How long ago did you do that? When did that start?
Well, it started in 1994. So it was like the early days of World Wide Web. I mean, there weren't many websites in 94. It predates a lot of very well-known sites. But it was the first Star Wars collecting website ever. And at the time, no one had done a whole website dedicated to Star Wars collecting. There were a few Star Wars websites. Not many, but I wanted one dedicated to Star Wars collecting, and so it kind of started there and grew a lot over the years.
Wow. Yeah, 1994 was probably the first time, I think that was the first year we got a computer, and I got into on the web and doing my own website and all that stuff, and I think that was the year, didn't they introduce graphics on the web that year or the year before or something like that? I know they were very new.
Web was a new phenomenon then. I'm not sure the exact timing there, but it was like months into the first adoption of websites. Originally it just started like friends and I wanted to just share photos of and information about cool Star Wars collectibles that none of us had ever seen before. And it was just kind of just for friends and a kind of a community effort. From there, you know, we realized over time it started to take on this form of, well, there's information we have that no one else has. And then the power of the kind of community of the web, you know, just, you know, bringing content from all sorts of people, put it in an interesting place in collecting, because prior to that, there hadn't been a lot written about Star Wars collecting. And so it allowed us to really rapidly evolve the information that got out to collectors about the hobby.
That's cool. So do you have a lot of, contributors to that site then?
Oh, yeah. Hundreds of people have contributed to the site over the years. We actually track that on the site. So anytime you look at an entry, you can see who the contributors are, like who, the photography, who owns the piece, who wrote the content, and it's all referenced. So you can look up people by name and then see all their other, from their link to their other contributions. So we track all that, and there's quite a few people who've done have helped us over the years.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, I was just browsing through it today, and I noticed you had some prototypes up there, and I saw that Gamorrean Guard prototype was a newer. That is like a prototype thing, the black pictures of them, right?
Yeah, the prototypes are definitely one of our specialties. It's one of my things I collect, and it's something that we really got into with just because a lot of us were so fascinated with the Kenner. Vintage Kenner toys, and so we got into like trying to learn the production process, all the different artifacts that come out of making and designing a toy, and then also toy concepts that were never released. And so the prototypes is one of the strengths of the archive. We really focus on that stuff, and we're still uncovering all sorts of prototypes that hadn't been discovered before. And so yeah, the Gamorrean Guard entries are just a couple recent things that were just added, but we're constantly finding new stuff to publish.
Cool. So you mean like you actually own some of these prototypes?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I have a pretty huge collection of those things. That's one of, I have an entire pretty large room in the house just dedicated to vintage Star Wars prototype. So, yeah, I mean, over the years, my friends and I have met hundreds of people at Kenner, like who used to work for Kenner Toy Company, and we would visit Cincinnati multiple times a year where Kenner was based, and we would find all sorts of pieces that people never knew about. It's a big focus of mine in collecting, and then a lot of the people who work on the archive are very fascinated by prototypes. And so, yeah, I have quite a few in my collection, and as do many of the other contributors to the archive.
Oh, that's very cool. I hope one day to be able to see some of those.
Come check it out.
Yeah. So, you know, I got to ask, you know, seeing your icon. So Gus has an icon on his Skype channel about it shows the Rocket Fire Boba Fett prototype. Do you actually have that one? The holy grail of Star Wars collecting?
I do. In fact, I have both kinds. There's one called L-Slot design, which is the one I have on my Skype photo. And then there's a one called the J-Slot. And they're just different ways that they kind of engineered how the firing mechanism would work on the Boba Fett. But that for me in prototype collecting, it's one of the, you know, holy grails you have to go for in prototype collecting. Like the quintessential Star Wars collectible is a rocket firing Boba Fett.
Yeah.
One of the first prototypes I picked up was that. I was a student at the time, so I didn't have a lot to spend on prototypes, but it was a huge splurge for me at the time. But it was like I was just determined to get one, and so for me it's like really defined Star Wars collecting in some way, and so that's why I use it as this icon, and it's, you know, it's just it really for me like a significant piece in Star Wars collecting.
Yeah, it's something that I would love to at least just see one of these days. And now, correct me, they never actually made a painted version. The only ones you can get are the solid gray, right?
Well, the L-Slot, there's some different ones. So the L-Slot version, which is the one in the picture, is the color is actually different than the production toy. So it's like a more blue than a gray.
Okay.
And it's usually found in a solid color like that in the photo. The later version, the J-Slot, those are usually found painted,
Really?
Like the production figure, yeah. And the J-Slots generally are rarer than the L-Slots. I mean, all of them are extremely rare. There's maybe 50 of these things in existence total. But the L-Slot ones are more common of the two, and the J's tend to be painted.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. Always learn something new on the Super Awesome Geek Show. Yeah, speaking of collecting, I guess. So you've also started a few collectors clubs in the Seattle area, right?
Yeah, I mean...
I
started one and then participated in another one. I mean, for me, collecting's always been, you know, more about the people you meet, friends you meet, and the networks you build. Obviously, we all love finding cool things and having them for our collections. I think... Sometimes people superficially think that, oh, well, that's all it's about, but it's actually the people you meet is a lot of the fun. And years ago, I had met a bunch of collectors in the Seattle area at toy shows and other Star Wars related things. It was like in the early 90s that I got the idea of, and told them, it's like, well, we should all get together. You know, we all have this common interest and we should do something together. And I got kind of the idea came for me from my wife and I were traveling in Australia in the early 90s, and we were visiting Hobart, Tasmania, which is a pretty, you know, remote, obscure place. And there they had a Star Wars collecting club. And I thought, well, if Hobart, Tasmania can have a Star Wars collecting club, there's no reason Seattle can't have one. And so when I got back from that trip, I just called up all these other guys I'd met at all these toy shows. I said, well, let's just start meeting. Let's just do this monthly. And so we formed the Sarlacc group in like mid-94. And, the group is still around. I mean, you know, 21 years later, still meets every month. We also do other activities like off-cycle things like we'll do we'll meet and do special events. Like last summer, a bunch of folks made, you know, kind of life-size, realistic-looking Ewoks. Other times we've visited filming locations, or we'll go to like visit Rancho Obi-Wan, or, you know, go to Celebration. So there's all these things we do all the time. And so they become really great friends over the years, and new people are constantly joining. And it just kind of snowballed from there. So I was kind of involved in kind of starting that. And then there's another group that formed, formed through kind of Rebel Scum website, where they do groups that kind of are more kind of public, and so for those groups, so Sarlacc group will generally meet in people's homes, and so
yeah.
Most people find out about it through word of mouth, because you're taking in people into their homes and so on.
Sure.
Whereas the Stars group, the other group, is more a kind of a public group. So they kind of announce it on the website where they're meeting. They get new members, and they meet kind of at a public place like a restaurant.
Oh, okay.
So those are the two groups in Seattle. There's other fan groups for Star Wars in Seattle, but the two collecting groups are those are the two collecting groups.
Sure. Yeah. So that would be Stars, right? The one that meets at the restaurant?
Correct. Yeah. Yes, that's Stars.
Okay. Yeah. And did you help start that, or was that more of the other guys kind
no,
of
No, other people started Stars.
Okay.
I mean, I started going to Stars events pretty early, but I didn't form it. I think it was more people that didn't know Sarlacc initially and you know, had kind of found each other on Rebel Scum, started forming it. And then what happened over the years is the two groups kind of
blended together.
People. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more or less the same people in both groups. So at this point, there was a time when they were kind of totally different groups.
I see. Yeah. I just recently joined both groups from meeting Tom Burgess with IGrewUpStarWars.com. And he kind of got me into both groups. And I went to one meeting so far of both, and I've enjoyed my time at both events. It's been pretty cool.
Yeah, and you know, and usually people like you did, you know, it's like where usually people find Stars first because it's a bit more public, and then from there get introduced to Sarlacc as well.
Sure,
so that's pretty typical.
What was that? It sounds like there's a monster at your house.
It was like a motorcycle going by.
Ah, yeah. I was wondering if the Sarlacc pit just swallowed you up. I heard that you guys, when you go to Celebration this year, you're going to take a detour and hit the actual location of the Sarlacc shooting, right?
Yeah, that's the plan. We're going to go one of the days while we're down there. We're going to go drive. It's kind of on the California-Arizona-Mexico border where those kind of three meet. Well, we're going to go over to the filming location for Sarlacc Pit. And I've been out there a few times before.
Okay.
But you can actually find pieces of the set kind of buried there.
Really?
So, yeah. So, you know, when you get there, you know exactly where you are. And so, pretty excited to go back. And, you know, since it's in April, it's a good time of year to visit because it'll not be – I've gone there in the middle of the summer, which is dreadful, you know, because it's a desert and it's pretty hot. And so should be a good time of year to go visit the location.
You know, for some reason in my head, I always thought that was also like a Tunisian location or something for whatever reason. I didn't realize that it was just like here in the States.
Yeah, for Return of the Jedi – they didn't do any Tatooine scenes in Tunisia, but they shot all that in the U.S. You know, the only outdoor shots were around the Sarlacc pit, and that was in the U.S. And that was because when they were filming, but it adds complications. When you film in the U.S., you then have press that is trying to, you know, kind of discover it. If you go to other countries, it's a little easier to hide from the press.
Yeah.
And so that's why they used this code name Blue Harvest to film Return of the Jedi, because they knew that a lot of press coverage would, you know, they'd try to figure out where they're filming a Star Wars movie in the U.S.
Yeah, because I had heard that they actually blew up the whole, what is it, the sail barge thing, right? Like,
yep.
They had made like a big one, a life-size one, and then they actually blew it up, right?
That's right. Yeah, they did. I had heard that. I mean, they did. They definitely did a bunch of pyrotechnics and blew up a lot of stuff for those shots. The scene you see in the movie, of course, is done with miniatures, but they did kind of a bunch of explosions there for that are added to it, and then they did haul away some of the pieces from it, but they also buried a bunch of it and left some of it there.
Okay. So you can actually find, like if you find something out there, can you actually recognize what it is, or do you just find, like, a piece of wood?
So, most of it's unrecognizable, but some of it you can figure out. Like there's pieces of fiberglass, pieces of wood, and kind of, like, foam latex pieces. And so you can kind of tell which ones were part of the Sarlacc pit and which ones might have been part of the barge, sail barge.
Okay.
Really recognizable things are tough at this point, but what's amazing is there's still plenty of stuff out there. I mean, the last time I was there, there were plenty of stuff out there, so it's just a lot of it's unrecognizable. I mean, at Celebration 4, which was in L.A., we went to the Sarlacc pit before Celebration and just retrieved tons of little pieces, and a friend and I did a panel on visiting the filming locations, and what we did was at the end of the panel just said, hey, by the way, we've got these pieces, you know, we'll give them out to the audience. If you guys are interested in a souvenir from the film, I'll just line up here and we'll give them out. So, like, every single person in the auditorium, like, lined up for a piece.
Oh,
and fortunately, we had hundreds of pieces, so it worked out okay. Everybody got one, but it was, like, people went nuts for these things, but it was a hit to give these out to people. So we're not going to do that this time, but it was great to be able to do that.
That's cool. Are you going to actually have anything at Celebration? Speaking of that,
like a
panel or something?
Oh yes. So I for Celebration I run the collecting track. For Celebration, I've done that since the first Celebration in 1999. So what that means is I pick all the presenters that speak on collecting topics. We have a room dedicated to the collecting panels, and we have panels all afternoon. You know, basically, they start around noon and then go till evening. Different panelists, different presenters on a whole range of topics from all over the world. There are giveaways. So we do, for all the presentations, there's a unique giveaway for each presentation. The last couple Celebrations, we've done these things called Star Tots, which are, little kind of, preschool looking versions of the Star Wars characters, and it's based on a vintage Kenner concept, from a toy concept that Kenner was going to do.
Okay.
And so we did for Celebration 6, we did Star Tots based on A New Hope, and then for Celebration Europe 2, we did Star Tots based on Trilogo Power of the Force series. So for Celebration Anaheim, we're going to be doing Empire Strikes Back themed Star Tots. So we'll give those out at every panel. We'll also have a collector's lounge where there's going to be a whole bunch of stuff going on. We're going to have people doing patch giveaways, button giveaways, author signings. We're going to have some collecting podcast folks presenting there. We have a very cool thing we'll announce soon that will also be in that room. We'll have some display cases with things on display. So there's a ton of stuff going on. So we have two rooms dedicated to collecting. There's a swap meet one of the nights of Celebration. So basically what we do is say every, it can be a collector, it can be a dealer, whoever, is just like whatever you can carry, one arm load of, we'll have on Saturday night of Celebration at 7 p.m., we'll have this collector swap meet in the collector's lounge and the panel room, and people will just, some of the coolest stuff you'll ever see for sale or trade will be among the things that we do at that.
Nice.
And yeah, basically run from noon till 8, noon till 7 every night of Celebration. It's fun, you know, and I've done this for them, for Lucasfilm, for all of the Celebrations.
So this is the seventh one, right?
This is the seventh one in the U.S.
States, yeah.
And then there was one in Japan, one in Great Britain, and one in Germany as well. So this is really the 10th Celebration.
Okay. And, speaking also of your own personal collection, now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I went to the EMP right now, at the Seattle EMP, they have the Power of the Costume, Star Wars and the Power of Costume. And in there is a Yoda, now that's a, was that like a production puppet? And that's from your collection, correct?
Yeah. So it's a rehearsal puppet. So it was a puppet designed so that Frank Oz and Mark Hamill could kind of rehearse the interactions with Yoda.
Okay.
So it actually looks more like, almost like a Muppet version of Yoda. And they used that to design the final Yoda puppet, but it was just kind of an early concept for a Yoda puppet, but that it's one that you could use, you know, and kind of, interact with. And, that Yoda puppet is actually seen in a lot of behind the scenes photography, from Empire Strikes Back.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it's a piece in my collection. And I've loaned pieces before to the EMP Museum. So the Death Star model that we have in our house, that was on loan to them for about 5 years. And okay. So for this costume exhibit, they wanted a piece towards the entrance of the exhibit, and so they borrowed the Yoda piece for that. And then there's about a half a dozen other prop pieces that they borrowed from me recently that they will they'll have in an exhibit they'll announce soon, but they'll be in March. So they're going to have a few more of my things will be there in March.
That's really cool. How did that like really come about? How did you get into donating things to museums or like the Seattle EMP? And then also I'd like to know, like, how does it feel to be able to give something that now the entire community can enjoy and go see at one of these locations, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is that, you know, yeah, as I've gotten through the years of collecting, you know, I like started like any other collector, you know, I like started with loose toys and I, you know, kind of built up, and it took me years to really get into things like movie props. You know, and then, but, you know, it's not lost on me that at some point in collecting this stuff that, you know, I have some unique things no one else has.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so because of that, you know, certainly established contacts with a lot of folks, like such as people who run museums, like the EMP folks, and the people at EMP have been great to kind of work with over the years. We've done various things. Like I've done things where I've kind of helped them on stuff before, either with information or, helped promote EMP and have done interviews for them and loaned them pieces before. But yeah, like something like the Yoda piece, you know, it's actually a pretty low impact for me. It's more like, you know, while I love having all these pieces at home, it's deciding, well, there's a few that I can kind of loan to them for a few years. It'll come back to the house after a few years, but it lets people see them in public. So so that's something that's kind of cool, is to like get something in front of people so they can appreciate it. And that's basically, you know, the thing is you want people to see some of these significant pieces. So it's kind of cool and humbling almost to see like the Yoda piece at an exhibit of these amazing Lucasfilm costumes, to actually see one of my pieces as part of it. And it's a little surreal when you're at a, you know, exhibit or a museum and you see your piece in a case and some random people are there commenting and talking about it, you know, and you kind of want to say, hey, that's mine, you know, it's, yeah, when the Death Star model was in the EMP Museum for a few years, it was always kind of fun to kind of hang out by the case and see people look at it and interact with it. And it's just shocking to me that, you know, to have a piece that people are looking at in a museum that's actually mine. But yeah, it's kind of a fun thing in collecting to get, you know, to have it go to a place where like people want to borrow your stuff for exhibits, is kind of cool. And at the same time, there are a few pieces they asked to borrow that I was like, ah, I don't really want it to leave the house right now, because I really love having it in the house. So it's kind of a balance of what's been around for a while that's okay swapping out for a little bit. So that's kind of, it's always a tough call, because I love having the stuff around me too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I appreciated it, because I could imagine there's got to only be, if there could only be one, if not like only less than five of those Yoda puppets around. And, you know, I can imagine it's something that's extremely scarce. So I think it's really good that you were able to put it in the display case like that, so everyone can enjoy it and go see it, where they otherwise might never have the chance to see that thing, you know?
Yeah, as far as I know, there are no other rehearsal puppets out there.
So there may have only been one?
And only been one. It may have been only been one. And then the final Yodas that they had in the film, all of those are in pretty bad state, the few that are left, because they were all made of foam latex, so those deteriorated really rapidly.
I see.
So actually, of Yoda props used in Empire Strikes Back, like the rehearsal puppet's really the closest thing that looks kind of like Yoda. The rest of them are really kind of in bad state. So I don't think I don't think there was anything Yoda related at the exhibit at EMP. I'd have to check my photos.
No, I don't think so. Other than that piece, no.
Yeah.
Yoda's always been one of my favorite characters, so I that's why I really enjoyed seeing him. I was like, wow, this is amazing, you know. And I probably sat there for 5 or 10 minutes just staring at the Yoda.
Yeah. I noticed, a lot of people just hanging by the Yoda when I was there. Like, it was so, and it's in its own little spot on the way up,
yeah.
Which is kind of.
Yeah, and so to get Jason and Rob talking a little bit,
yes.
I did hear that you, the other night, I met Gus at one of the collectors club meets, and he was saying that he had got a chance to go to Toy Fair. And, I was wondering, you know, do you guys have any questions for Gus about Toy Fair? And, maybe Gus could give us a little bit about the experience of being there, because it's something that I know we've all wanted to do.
Well, actually, I got one question real quick, Gus, because, you know, you talk about, you know, seeing folks interacting with the pieces, you know, in your collection in the museum. Does it, and I know that, you know, obviously that's really cool, but out of curiosity, have you ever witnessed any interactions that made you really nervous that this really awesome, unique piece was, you know, not behind lock and key?
Yeah, at museums, no. I mean, usually they're fairly well preserved and there's tons of security. So I've never seen, there's pretty much nothing you could do to me. Like an EMP, if they have a piece, there's pretty much nothing someone could do that would damage a piece.
Mm-hmm.
In our house, generally pretty good about the more valuable stuff or fragile things behind locked cases, so that there were okay. The only time, you know, we have some things that are more loose and accessible. The only times we ever really seem to have an issue are when, you know, we'll sometimes get families to come through, we'll have little kids, and, you know, many little kids are well-behaved, and even if they're not well-behaved, many kids have parents that keep them in check and control the kids and make sure the kids don't do crazy stuff. The worst thing, and this happens only happened a few times, is when you get kind of a wild kid, and it's one of those parents that just lets the kid just run wild, and
oh,
just like
no.
You know, that's usually bad news, where we have to kind of play referee and just stop the kid from grabbing things. And you know, usually, like, I you know, it's great to, when, in fact, it's wonderful when kids come over and check out stuff, but you also want to make sure they're either well-behaved and or that their parents are kind of, you know, kind of watching them. And sometimes you get parents that are fairly lazy about that, and then then it's a mess. But when it's a, like an unruly kid with parents that don't, they seem to let them do whatever, that's the only time. Most of the time, it's things are pretty well, you know, protected. I try to, in my house, I have things framed up behind cases, so most of the stuff that could be really damaged is fairly well protected.
Right on. Cool, man. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, you just have to wonder if you know, the flip side of, you know, having your pieces in public.
Yeah, it's okay for the stuff, you know, but I wouldn't loan to anyone. So there are people that do want to borrow my things for exhibits, and I say no way. And, you know, it's usually ridiculous circumstances, like they want to ship it across the country. It's not really clear. It's kind of an amateuristic kind of setup or something, you know. So there I just decline them. I mean, the EMP is like a really top-notch museum, so
oh, yeah,
they're going to do a great job with it. But there are people that have asked to borrow things, and I just say no way.
Discretion being the better part of valor, right?
Yeah.
I'd like to touch on Toy Fair. I want to know, like, what the experience is like, because I'm sure, I mean, I know Rob and Jason would love to go just as much as I would.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. All my years in collecting, I've obviously known about Toy Fair and read a lot about Toy Fair. But I read a lot about the toy industry. I'm very fascinated with the toy industry. But I've never actually gone to Toy Fair until last year, and then this year was my second time there. And I thought all these years it wouldn't be that interesting to me, because I don't collect the new toys anymore. And, you know, it's just not my thing. But I love Toy Fair. I think it's amazing. Like, I want to kind of figure out a way to go every year. It's pretty awesome because, first of all, there are lots of friends who are into collecting who are there at Toy Fair.
Okay.
It's fun meeting all the different licensees, and they're working on Star Wars and see all the products coming out. I mean, they even have, like, foreign licensees that don't even sell things in the U.S. but are just licensed for their countries. Like, there was a company that made puzzles in Poland that was there, and they can't sell the puzzles in the U.S., but they're licensed to do Star Wars puzzles. Huh. So I picked up their retailer catalog. So it's kind of cool. Like, you get to see all this stuff, and there's some exclusives that they just provide as samples to people there. And you know, it was great. And then, like, you know, companies like Hasbro do events for websites and bloggers, so that you know, and podcasts, and basically they let, you know, people who are based effectively press, go, you know, first of all, if you're press, and that can be website, blog, podcast, gets pretty much free access to Toy Fair.
Oh, cool. So next year we can go.
It's really easy. It's really easy for people covering it to get in. And that's how I got in. I mean, I cover it through on my website, you know, just basically you state your credentials for, you know, where, you know, you use social media, to cover it. And, you get in, and, they have special events. Some of the big manufacturers have events for people covering it, particularly from collector standpoint. So Hasbro did an event where they covered this, and it was great. And they show, you know, presentation of all this upcoming product. They then take you through their showroom of all the new products coming out, and so you see all the different products, and you get to interact with them. And then at the end, on your way out, they give you like a gift bag of a whole bunch of different products.
Oh, cool.
And then the same is true with some of the other companies as well. So many of them gave out some really cool products. Some of them have amazing displays on the show floor, mm-hmm. like Funko and Super 7, who do, you know, the pops,
pop vinyl guys, mm-hmm. yeah,
pop vinyl guys, and then the reaction action figures. All that had wonderful displays. So there's a bunch of these companies have displays on. I think Toy Fair is an amazing place to go if you love toys. And then it was fun interacting with some of the other collectors there. You know, even people who don't collect Star Wars, like other people, like one of the funny moments was, so we went to the Hasbro event, and then a bunch of us went to grab some food at like a local restaurant in Manhattan. And we saw some of the guys coming into the restaurant who were also carrying the Hasbro gift bags coming out of the event. And so we're talking to this guy who's like a Transformers collector.
Yeah.
And all of us are Star Wars guys, you know, he's a Transformers mm-hmm. guys, and so it was kind of cool because we could swap, you know, trade our Transformers stuff for their Star Wars stuff
nice.
And in the bags. But it was funny, we were talking to him and saying, hey, we've got a question for you. You know, when they did those Star Wars Transformers, do Transformers collectors collect that? You know, what do they think of that? And he's like, no, we hate that. In fact, none of the Transformers collectors like the Star Wars Transformers. They really despise them. And we're like, well, that's funny, because the Star Wars collectors are like, we hate those things too. We thought it was you guys that wanted those things. And had this realization that, like, neither community liked those things, you know. Which I
building
was,
bridges.
Yeah,
that's funny, because Jason is a big Transformer. Well, actually, Jason and Rob both collect Transformers, and I do Transformers and Star Wars. And I've passed on all those Transformers Star Wars prototype or combination things as well.
Oh yeah, same here. I hate it
really,
all.
I'm really happy about that, because I've got a bunch of them for really cheap. Oh. Thank you.
Okay. The one exception was that big-ass Darth Vader Death Star Transformer. Thing is happily on my shelf. That thing is so badass. Although the goofy-ass fabric cape, that I don't know why they thought that was a good idea, but I love that piece. That is the only piece out of that entire line, though, that I was just like, gotta have that. That's really cool.
I just don't know many people into that line, but that's good that found one that really liked.
So I know that we're mostly talking Star Wars here, but because Transformers is my second love, I got to say how was it seeing the Devastator? I mean, did you at least look at that gigantic green combiner Transformer?
Yeah. No, I thought it was cool. There was a funny moment, though, I have to admit, because I'm not a Transformers person.
Sure,
so you got to understand, like, when I look at Transformers, there was a very funny moment when we were there. I was sitting next to a friend who's into Star Wars. It's not into Transformers like myself. I don't hate Transformers, just not into it.
Yeah.
They're going through the Transformers presentation, and then they show one, and then they'll show one and go, look, a robot that turns into a truck. And then they show another one, look, another robot that turns into a truck. You know, and it became this kind of punchline, and we start getting giggles through this presentation. We're like, okay, don't embarrass ourselves, you know. We're like at this, like, formal presentation. And, but, you know, we were also realizing the irony that, you know, like, of course, when people look at Star Wars and they see us obsessed over this Cantina alien versus this, to them it's all the same. You know, it all looks the same. Why do you care so much? Or the X-Wing versus the Y-Wing versus the B-Wing, you know, it all looks the same. But it was kind of funny, you know, just watching it, and then they're like, oh, look, a big Transformer that has green vehicles, you know. It's like, it was just kind of like, you know, but it was, yeah, I mean, it was cool. Obviously, the scale of it and all that, it's awesome. But, it was kind of, we were also trying to keep ourselves from just cracking up at that point, because we were, you know, from our standpoint, I'm sure if you're really into the show and know the characters and stuff, it's great.
While you were saying that, it did just occur to me that most of the new line is trucks. I mean, it's Optimus Prime, it's Ultra Magnus, it's...
When fandoms collide.
Yeah. So, but I mean, a lot of this new Star Wars stuff for Episode 7 was behind lock and key, right? You couldn't really see a lot of that, right?
That's right. They wouldn't show it. They'd only show it to big retailers. They had specific instructions to not show it to press. But it was behind lock and key. They did have it there, and they did show it to retailers, but you couldn't. It was not on the show floor. So one of the clever things I saw was Revell, the guys who make the model kits. What they did is they did mock-up boxes in the same size and proportions and skill levels that they will be issuing Force Awakens toys. And they were just blank white boxes with Force Awakens logo on it. But what I loved about the way they did it is you could kind of visualize to some degree, like, what are the different skill levels, sizes of model kits, but they couldn't reveal what it was. But it was a good way to kind of bridge the two, whereas a lot of the other manufacturers would just have a big poster with Force Awakens, and that was it. And so it was like, at least Revell let you use your imagination a little bit of what they were going to be releasing. So that was kind of nice that they did that.
Yeah, it's because, I guess a lot of it was behind what they have, like curtains or side rooms or something?
Yeah, a lot of them have, like, closed areas, and then they would just have people, they'd have to sign huge NDAs to get access to that. So people sign their life away, and then they would get to go check out the Force Awakens toys.
Yeah, I just think that's a lot of it's because they don't want to have any kind of pictures or any kind of release until we're closer to the film, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, Jason, Rob, did you have any specific toy fair questions that he might be able to answer?
No. You've probably already answered this on your blog, but, like, what was the best toy you saw there?
It's interesting. I don't know about the best. There's one that I thought was... made me cringe when I first saw it that ended up growing on me, which is interesting. They had when you go to the Hasbro area, they had like a life-size Furby Chewbacca.
I saw the, uh, I,
that's not,
I've seen the pictures on the social media.
And the life size one was just some dude in a suit, but it wasn't the actual toys like, you know, kind of the size of like grapefruit. But it's called Furbaka. And I thought, oh my God, this thing is so horrible. Like, I can't believe they're making this thing. But then in the showroom, they had one you could interact with. And I was like, I love this thing. It was so cool. It was like, the Furby would sing like Star Wars theme, and it would just have these really cool interactions. I was like, oh, now I'm convinced I got to get one of these things. Like, I was thinking, this is the lamest thing I ever. And then once you actually play with it, you're like, wow, this is actually a great toy.
And it makes like the Wookiee noises.
Oh yeah, it does all sorts of noises. It tries to it does Wookiee noises, and it sings along to various songs and will say things from the movie and it's been a few years since I've kind of looked at a Furby, but it looks like the technology's improved a bit on the Furby. I liked it. I thought it was a really cool concept. So we'll awesome. See what happens.
Nice. You got any, Rob?
God, not in particular. Shoot. I mean, there was just so much stuff that came out of Toy Fair that looked really amazing. Actually, did you get a chance to check out the Tamashii Nation's like Samurai Star Wars figures? Did you actually wind up seeing any of those down there?
Yes, I saw the ones. They had a whole bunch for Rebels, and so. They did show anything. They did show things not associated with the new movie. So they showed some of the new, figures coming out, and some of the new vehicles, and then some things from Rebels as well. So they had some of that out.
Now they did the that cool looking Darth Vader that I've seen online, right? With the slashing sword and all that, and the cool like samurai sort of outfit.
Yeah. So they the displays I wound up seeing were they redesigned Darth Vader and stormtroopers in to make them. Looked like they were basically in samurai armor with like a katana lightsaber for Darth Vader and whatnot. And they look really wicked cool.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I saw those. I'm just going through my pictures right now. I think if those were there. I don't think that was in the – I don't remember seeing those in the Hasbro showroom. But
No, these would have been in
it was a Kotobukiya maybe? Or
No, it was
You just said it, Rob, didn't you?
Tamashii Nation.
There you go.
Okay. Nations. I know what you're talking about. There was some pretty interesting Star Wars stuff all throughout. I mean, they clearly a lot of these companies now are licensing Star Wars for this year because they know it's going to be a big year.
Yeah, like Hot Toys announced a Star Wars license too.
Yeah, and my understanding is that, and I don't quote me on this, but is my understanding is that Disney, in their licensing, is pretty open about having multiple companies licensing in the same product area. Like, so in other words, in the old days of Lucasfilm, like once somebody had such and such license, another company couldn't have the license. Was I don't think they do the exclusive thing as much with Disney. So you'll see, I think, multiple people doing action figures than that kind of thing. So that's good. That provides a lot of hope that there'll be quite a diversity of stuff.
Great. So. You know, one quick little thing though. Do you feel, based on what you saw, the 3¾-inch Star Wars figure is still going to stay alive? Right.
I think so.
All right.
I think it's such a classic I think it'll stay alive. In fact, with the new movie and all that, it should do quite well. I mean, it should. Yeah. I should really boost that.
I've just noticed a lot of other Hasbro lines going to the 2-inch. You know, Guardians of the Galaxy is now 2-inch. A lot of the I saw for the new Avengers Ultron film, they're all 2-inch. So I'm just kind of getting concerned because
2-inch.
I'm not going to collect the 2-inch figures. I want the 3¾. And if they did that with Star Wars, I think I'd be hard pressed to get any of the new figures. But if they stay in the 3¼-inch, I'm all for it. You know.
Yeah.
It seems like they're trying to convert the 3¾-inch. Kind of figure to a more premium space anyway with like the black line and whatnot, where they're really putting a lot more articulation into the smaller toys.
And detail and accessories, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, that means more tooling and more expense. So I wonder if you know, the 2-inch is becoming more of the regular format for sort of the rank and file, and the 3¾ is becoming much more of a premium kind of collector format.
Yeah, and if anyone's going to pay premium, it'll be Star Wars fans, right?
Yeah. I would just, I mean, that, you know, companies like Hasbro have to constantly deal with the fact that you have this two different, very different demographics in toys. You have the kids buying them, but then you also have the collectors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and do you, sometimes you have to balance the two in the same product, but they might be going down a path of like sell very different products to each community.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could see that for the Marvel and, for the Marvel figures, I could see that being more kid-driven, and so they want to make more product for the kids to play with. Whereas I think there's a lot of diehard Star Wars fans that just that are adult collectors of those things, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know in the, at least on my end of things, because I'm in, you know, on the comic book end of things for the most part, kind of work in a shop, you know, they've already had a separate kind of space that's been growing for a while, you know, or a dichotomy between your normal kind of consumer product line and the more, you know, premium collector line. You know, like in comic shops and whatnot, you'll see tons of you know, product like Kotobukiya and whatnot that you'll never see in Target and whatnot.
That's true, yeah, definitely. So,
yeah, there's definitely some lines like Gentle Giant and Sideshow. Those,
oh, yeah.
I can't imagine kids really collecting that stuff.
Oh, God, no.
Yeah.
Speaking of, it was cool to see some of that Gentle Giant stuff at the last Sarlacc meet. I've never even seen some of that stuff, and it was really nice to get a chance to look at a few of those Gentle Giants, and now it kind of makes me want some.
They do beautiful pieces.
Yeah.
They really, really do.
Yeah.
There's quite a lot of stuff they've done over the years, too. And, yeah, very high quality.
So, Gus, before we get into wrapping it up, I always like to know, since we're a geek show, is Star Wars your main thing, or do you geek out about other stuff as well?
I mean, I geek out about other stuff, but it's Star Wars kind of fills most of my time. So it's, I do, you know, as far as, like, fandom things, you know, like, different properties, I'm not really into, you know, say, science fiction or comic characters. I mean, I like movies and things for some of these other, you know, like Lord of the Rings or the Marvel movies or that kind of stuff. But for me, in terms of collecting and kind of fan base geeking out on stuff, it's really about Star Wars for me. You know, in my career and stuff, I do things, you know, a lot, you know, online and with, you know, with software and so on, which is a different kind of a geek kind of area. But in terms of, like, you know, yeah, fandom and stuff, it's really for me just about Star Wars.
And I guess getting into that, like, do you have, like, a favorite Star Wars related memory?
Yeah, it's hard to pick a single one. I mean, I have certainly tons of memories, tons of things I'm very nostalgic about with Star Wars. I mean, certainly seeing them back in the days when the films were out, and I would wait, you know, a new movie would come out and wait in line and go see it, and that was quite a you know, an experience and you know, very, you know, memorable for me. I'd say, you know, there's tons of memories I have from this. I mean, I'm from, like, the first time I went to Tunisia to go see the filming locations there, you know, to just, like, a lot of great, wonderful parties, meeting different collectors at things like Celebration. So it's just constant, you know, kind of so much of my life is this, that it's hard to pick one single, you know, kind of event. You know, and then also the thrill of the hunt of finding some of these things, like finding, you know, in things like some of the props I have, like, coming across them. Like, I have, for example, a Tusken Raider mask from the first movie, one of only four ever made for the movie. They made four for it. And a guy who had contacted me about it, and I was able to screen match the piece, and I could point out which Tusken is on screen. I was like, okay, this is awesome. Like, to have this. This was only a couple of years ago. To have something like that land in my lap like that was just amazing. So there are things like that that also kind of are great kind of anecdotes. But yeah, I mean, actually, when people come to our house and tour the house, like almost every piece you show them is, like, got a great story behind it. I mean, there's so many of those stories.
Nice. You know, and speaking of going on locations, you said you went to Tunisia. Have you ever had the chance to go to any of the Hoth locations? Because, like, Hoth from Empire Strikes Back is probably my most favorite battle. And favorite planet scenes, you know?
Yeah, I've actually, so I've been to all the Star Wars filming locations. So that includes Hoth scenes in Norway, the forests in Great Britain, the Redwood Forest in the United States for Return of the Jedi, the Sarlacc Pit, Death Valley where they did Tatooine, Tunisia, I've been four times, I've been to Norway, as I mentioned, Spain and Italy were used in the prequels. So I've been to a lot of, I've also toured some of the studios, like Elstree Studios in London. Now, the Hoth ones are interesting in Norway. So the thing with that is there's only like a certain window of time in the year where it kind of looks like Empire Strikes Back. So if you go in the summer, a lot of the snow melts at the lower altitude, and even on the glacier, it melts a little bit there. If you go in the middle of winter, you can have blizzard conditions, and it's fairly unbearable to go there. So I've gone there a few times. The best experience I had, I went there in April, and we took like snowmobile out to the filming location, and we had this guide that was awesome because we would just have photos of different things, like different scenes in the battle, you know, where Luke is, you know, kind of boarding his X-Wing to where the Probot was, all these scenes. And he would drive us all around in a snowmobile all over the glacier and would find the exact filming locations for all these things, because you would think filming Hoth would be like, well, it's all white, it's just snow, but almost every scene has mountains in the background, so you can find the exact spot and line up the mountains. And so it's actually a really great location. But it's also a difficult location because, first of all, you need good weather, and it's a tough place for good weather. The weather's constantly changing there. A lot of times it's clouded over. You really need clear skies to appreciate it so that you can see the mountains. And it's also hard to get, I mean, it's you know, it's basically in a pretty rough area. You have pounded by snow and winds and you have to be careful too, because you could, in the glacier, you could fall in a crevasse or something, you know, if you're not careful. And, But it's one of my favorite locations. It was an amazing location. It's also expensive to visit. So the place that we went to, Norway's an expensive country to begin with. And then this the lodge there, which is the hotel they stayed at when they filmed Empire Strikes Back, is not cheap to stay at. And then renting a snowmobile there is not cheap. So you spend a lot of money to go see this location. But it's, you know, it's an amazing experience to see that. But I was able to match up pretty much every shot from Hoth scenes. Like every single shot, we could find the location.
That's cool. Yeah, really, really. Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, I could swear that the snowmobile was powered on $100 bills. Like you burn $100 because it was like your expense. You rent snowmobile out there.
Yeah, I'd be scared of looking over my shoulder and hearing that bitty 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 Probot noise, right? Well, hey Gus, you know, I think that's pretty good. You know, if you're good, we can let you go for the evening. Thank you for coming on. I appreciate you coming on and spending some time with us.
Yeah, it's fun to be on. So glad I can join you.
Yeah, thanks for coming on and listening in, Rob and Jason, being on with us.
Oh yeah, for sure. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Gus.
Thanks, guys.
Have a good one.
Yeah, and I look forward to seeing some of the events you have going both at Emerald City and at Celebration. It'll be really cool.
Yeah, look forward to it.
All right, thanks, Gus.
Yep, bye.
Bye. You've been listening to the Super Awesome Geek Show with John Adams, Jason Rigdon, Eric Locke, Matt B., and Rob Clifford. The Super Awesome Geek Show is part of Kingdom of the Geeks. We put up new episodes every Friday. You can find us on iTunes and on the website at superawesomegeekshow.com. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/superawesomegeekshow. Follow us on Twitter at Awesome Geek Show. And if you'd like to help, you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/superawesomegeekshow. Or make one of the purchases of our fine toys, art, and collectibles on the eBay store, stores.ebay.com/kingdomofthegeeks. All your support does help, and we really, really appreciate it. If you'd like to be on the show, just contact us, superawesomegeekshow@gmail.com. Well, that about wraps it up. Thanks a lot for listening, and see you next Friday on the Super Awesome Geek Show!